Welcome to the Landscaping Podcast. My name is Joel Barnett and I am your host. And in today's episode, I'm talking with Andrew Fisher-Tomlin from the London College of Garden Design. Andrew's one of the co-founders of the London College Garden Design and is a hell of a lot of fun to talk to. It's a really enjoyable episode. I'll certainly laugh a fair few times in it, but it's awesome just to talk to someone who's passionate about what they do. And Andrew is certainly another one of them. He's got some great bits of advice throughout the conversation, as well as some of the pathways that he took, some great bits of advice as well. Like, for example, when he started out, he wasn't sure exactly what he wanted to do within the industry. So he worked in horticulture, design, and construction and spent several years in each one. And he'd gone on to do things such as chairing the selection of gardens that get built at Chelsea, and he's involved in the judging there as well over, I think it was an 8-year period. So he's got a pretty impressive CV. And there's one point I absolutely loved that he talked about in some of the show gardens that he's done, like a couple of them that he won best in show. And they were two gardens that he'd worked with that had the lowest budget. So he spoke about how when you are working with a lower budget, you get more creative and more resourceful. You can often come up with better ideas. And when he was judging at Chelsea, none of the gardens that had the biggest budgets ever seemed to win. So that was a great point. But yeah, just an extremely knowledgeable person and so much fun to talk to. So hopefully you enjoy this chat with Andrew Fisher-Tomlin. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on the Landscaping Podcast. My first question for you is, how did you start in the industry?
It's quite a big question, isn't it? I started in horticulture. That's kind of like my first love. And I came from a family of gardeners, a few professional parts gardeners and printers, bizarrely. I don't know why I said bizarrely then. No, but anyway. So horticulture, and I studied at Askham Bryan College in Yorkshire. And then this was at a moment when design was really taking off. Kind of, garden design was becoming a thing and it got onto television and that. And so when I actually started out in my own business, I did 4 years, middle year placement, finished with a year at University of Leeds. And I, to be honest, I only stayed on and did that degree year because I got the opportunity to do Chelsea Flower Show if I did it. So kind of I went straight into doing that. And it never gave me a bug, funnily enough. I didn't do another show garden for 15 years. Ah. I came out of there, horticulture, was being asked to do design. So in many ways, kind of almost self-taught. But I was always taking the jobs where there was a lot of planting. So I kind of pulled the two together and became a planting design specialist. And it kind of allows me to pursue both loves, really, and work in collaboration with lots of people like Dan Bowyer, who now owns Fisher-Tomlin and Bowyer, and I kind of work for him, but also architects and work in public space. Things like we've worked on stuff like the Olympic Park and with clients like Blind Veterans, but I'm there primarily for the plants, and that's where it comes from. And I'm one of those people that kind of wasn't sure what I wanted to do, so I tried everything. So I did a bit of design. I had a construction business for about 8 years. Strangely enough, the business partner I have there went back to Perth and I decided I wasn't going to do construction anymore. So yeah, lots of stuff, but the last 20 years has really been about planting.
So with that first Chelsea experience, what was that experience that you did there?
That was funded by the Morrisons family. And Morrisons, for anyone who knows the UK, is a big supermarket chain owned by family. I think not so much now. I think it's more sort of there's a bigger shareholding there. But they had an educational trust and put the money up for it, based in Leeds. Askham Bryan's in York and just down the road. And so did a garden there around the opening of a new museum for the Royal Armouries. So kind of a strange mix of things. And the Royal Armouries were moving from the Tower of London and opening there. They still are in Leeds. And so there's kind of a lot of steel and things in it. And strange enough, when we were talking earlier about show gardens having a life afterwards, and that garden went up to Roundtable Park in Leeds, and I visited it 2 years ago. I hadn't been there for about 20 years. And it's still there. And it's a lesson in why you shouldn't plant birch trees. Because I remember being on television with Alan Titchmarsh talking about how you should clean up your birch trees with soap and water, especially if you're at a Chelsea Flower Show. So for anyone who doesn't know, Alan Titchmarsh is kind of like the Graham Ross of the UK. And they're not, birch trees are kind of not good climate change trees. So yeah.
Like dying out the top, or what is it that's bad?
A number of reasons, really. Because designers love them. They just adore birch trees.
Group of threes.
They don't formative prune well. They're one of only two trees I can name that kind of look rubbish once you prune them. The other one's mulberry. And who plants them? You don't plant many mulberry in your life, you plant them for yourself. They're not good with climate change. So places like Kew Gardens are losing them. As a species, they're probably one of the worst at the moment. And also, they're really highly allergenic. They're kind of one of the worst trees you can have in your garden if you've got people in your family who've got allergies. So there's not a lot going for them, as far as I'm concerned, apart from, a white bark. But, I mean, look at the trees you've got. You've got things like Largostromia. Why wouldn't you rather have that than a birch tree,
Yep.
Or it's a grizzly or whatever, So, anyway.
Yeah, that is my go-to tree, Largostromia, because there's so many different varieties as well and different sizes. Yeah. There's the Tonto, which is only like 3 by 3 meters, so there's heaps of different ones.
Well, I was out of nurseries last week, and I can't believe how cheap Largostromia is for you.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's a tree that's really only been been resilient in the UK for the last 10 years, really. We're kind of experimenting with a street tree. I'm told that kind of in down here in Melbourne, it's not being used as a street tree so much. I wanted to have a conversation with somebody about that and why that is, because we're starting to grow it. I was telling my students today, actually, what the Japanese call it. Do you know what the Japanese? It's called monkey slippy tree.
Because they slip when they climb up it.
It slipped down the trunk. So there you go.
It's very well descripted.
Yeah.
So, and what was the reason for not going back for 15 years? Did you not enjoy it, or what was the?
I think with show gardens, you get a bug for it. And I didn't get that bug for it. I was more kind of intent on setting my business up. I was getting some really good jobs early on. I remember kind of in the first 6 months, this is a very long time. I would almost say Victorian times. I got a really fabulous job for a private client, and who was a well-known TV ad director. And he was just a joy to work with, from a design point of view. And I was kind of enjoying all that and finding my way. So I didn't really feel the need to. I did a little bit more than around 2007-08, I was asked to be an RHS judge and also select gardens, and I ended up chairing the selection of gardens for Chelsea Flower Show for a while. And it was interesting, and I'd done a few show things. I often did exhibits for things like the RHS Science Department. So rather than judged show gardens, I was quite happy to do a bit of that and enjoy the build-up. And then 2015, I decided that I wanted to have another go at it. There are quite a lot of people, I have to say, who judge at shows, and then the next show they go and exhibit, and I don't think that's a good thing to do. I think you separate the two. So I stopped in 2015, and I thought, I'll do a show garden. So I went as far away as I could possibly do, and went to New Zealand in a show garden there. I thought, if it all goes horribly wrong, nobody will notice. Fortunately, it went quite well. So that was the Ellerslie Flower Show. And we did, myself and a colleague, Tom Parfitt, we did a couple of gardens. And it was a garden I'd wanted to do for a long time. So that was good. The week I came back, I got a phone call from AGB Events, who are in Sydney, and said, would you come and do a show there? So I went and did a show feature there with Michael Bates. Brilliant landscaper and really good fun. And we did, until 2018, a huge garden there. And the brief was to show what I, to do an Australian garden. and I was only allowed to do Australian natives. The kind of day the show opened, I realised what they wanted was kind of an English-style Australian garden in some way. And I hadn't done that. I did what my... I'd never been to Australia. And I did what was my idea of an Australian garden. And all these people were coming up and going, oh, it's like my mum's bush garden and things. And so obviously in the back of my mind, I watched too many films or something, and this is what I've done. And it was kind of a great joy to use these plants that I couldn't use back home. And... you know, if I'd put eucalyptus in a garden in the UK, they would have laughed at me because that's kind of so invasive. But I could do all these things. And the biggest sort of revelation to me was that all the other designers at the show, so people like Miles Baldwin and Brent Reed, came along and they said, oh, we can tell you're from Europe. And I was like, how can you tell? And they said, well, it's the way you put your plants together. And I was like, really? And I went over and had a look at their gardens with them. And yeah, it was really different. It's kind of really interesting how you kind of learn a way in it's sort of within you, you know. And I really enjoyed that experience. And I met Brent Reed, who is the director of London College of Garden Design in Melbourne now. So yeah. It was good. I can't even remember what your question was. You can tell.
No, that's all right. When you went to New Zealand, how did you go about getting a contractor? Was it part of, did the show organisers help with that, or did you have to organise someone?
Well, you remember I said I was a contractor as well?
Yeah.
Tom and I built it ourselves.
Oh, cool.
With two volunteers. It was called Sometimes You Need to Look Behind You. And it came from an idea I had that people talk about having tree seats and they never look at the tree, they look at the view. So we worked with a fantastic guy in the north of the South Island who made me a 36-seater tree seat, which you sat in and it had where you went in because it looked at the tree and the tree trunk was in the middle. We sat it underneath a 125-year-old London plane tree in the park there. Surrounding this tree seat were about, I think we used about 600 tree ferns. And where there was a little more light coming through, we had more tree ferns. And where there was less, there were the kind of more sparse and things. So you could come into this, you could pull in a chair, which formed a complete circle, and just look at the tree. And we did that regularly throughout the show. People just came. And people didn't touch the tree. It was amazing. It was kind of like this altar. And they sat on this fabulous bench, which you can still sit on. We gave it to the Botanic Gardens in Christchurch. And that was just an amazing piece of work the guy David did for us. And it wasn't until the last day that a very nice elderly lady came in on a mobility scooter and raced round and round the trunk, hit it, and then went out again. I think she was the only one to actually touch the tree. But it was kind of an amazing experience. And it was kind of, you have to design to fit your budget, to fit what you're capable of. And we thought we're capable of building something like that. And it kind of worked out okay. So, yeah.
And then how was the Sydney experience?
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, that first year, really enjoyed it. And then the second year, I was over 4 weeks and it didn't rain one day. It literally rained. And on the last day of the show, we had a kind of about 4 meter moat around the garden, and we had to let people come across on boards and look at the garden from the inside. It was sponsored by St. Vincent's Hospitals. They were great to work with. And I do a lot of work around designing for dementia. And I remember having a conversation with the ABC science program about gardens and dementia. And there was myself, the reporter, and one of the consultants from St. Vincent's. And it was amazing experience just kind of stand there in this garden and talk about all that. So I really, really enjoyed that. And it kind of then, by then I'd done enough gardens to go back to the UK and do a few. So a mate of mine has a charity which is all about Crohn's disease, called Bowel Disease UK. And we created a garden for a young person because it's Crohn's disease is a young person's, disease. Well, it's for all people, but people often find out. And I remember this grandmother coming up and telling me that her 4-year-old grandson had just been diagnosed with it. And it's a horrible thing. But we created a garden for Scott, a young person in the 20s who loved collecting plants. So it was kind of me, you know. and we worked on an absolute minuscule budget, and we won Best in Show. We kind of cleared up on things. BBC didn't want to feature it because the charity was called Bowel Disease UK. And I kind of pointed out to them that they'd done a whole campaign around Crohn's disease on Radio 1, which I guess is kind of young person's radio. And I said to the charity, I said, right, we're going to do our best so they can't ignore us. And in the end, they put us on. But I had a budget of £9,000. So my lowest budget, so that's what, $18,000.
Yeah.
My lowest budget. Lowest two budgets I've had, because I did another show, Garden, for who was that for? Oh, for Blind Veterans UK, and so 9,000 and 11,000, and those are the ones I've won Best in Show on. Because I think it forces you to be creative. You know, a Chelsea Flower Show Garden at the moment. There's a charity that's giving money to other charities to do these gardens. And for a large garden, which is 10 by 20 metres, they're giving them $1.2 million. And I just think that there's something wrong with that. I can't agree with that. You know, it doesn't seem right. And also, when I was selecting and judging gardens for RHS for over about 8 years, I never saw the garden with the biggest budget win Best in Show. And often they didn't even get a gold medal.
Yeah.
I think sometimes big budgets make designers lazy. I think small budgets make you really creative. And if you want to see new ideas and designers with no kind of baggage, go and look at the emerging designers. Go and go to the small shows where people are working on a tight budget. You're almost sure that you'll see something in 2 or 3 years' time. There'll be some big name going, oh, look at me, aren't I great? Because I'm doing this. And you think, yeah, I saw it, seen it before.
Yeah, the achievable gardens at the Melbourne Flowering Garden Show are always the most popular. Or they're right up there now because they're like student designers and they've got little, I think they might be 5 by 3 or something like that, meters. So yeah. They're small spaces. So it's, yeah, more bang for your buck.
Well, that's kind of why, I mean, you know, with London College of Garden Design, we want to encourage new people into the industry and things. But that's kind of why we run this borders competition, because it's something you get 2 days. It's 2.5 square meters, 2.5 by 2.5 meters. And you can kind of just come and find out what it's like to be involved in a show, you know, see what everybody else is doing, see how much fun people are having or not, and then decide if you want to go from there. It's a competition we started running 2 years before we started in Melbourne in the UK. And there's people who've done that competition that now have won Best in Show at Chelsea. So it kind of, you know, people find out if they want to do it, they experiment a bit, see what works, find out how difficult it is, and go forward from there. So hopefully that's the case. And certainly there are people, I know there are people at the show this year doing sort of emerging designers and things like that, that kind of started on that. You kind of had to progress it. Everybody who's ever said to me, oh, I'd only ever do Chelsea Flower Show, I've never seen them at Chelsea Flower Show. Yeah. You kind of start small and build up to something like that. And then you go to someone like Chelsea and you think, yeah, it's not all that it's made out to be.
Mm, yeah. The fellow, Riley Cooper, at this year's garden shows, he started, he did an achievable garden, and then he went up to the boutique garden, which is a 5 by 5 meter. And then this year he's done the big one. So, it's pretty cool seeing people work their way through it.
Yeah, and they kind of, you know, they can prove to a sponsor that they can do it. You know, they start small, get bigger, yeah. And that. I'm fine if you can get a big budget and go straight into Melbourne and do a big garden category. That's fine. But you kind of, you know, I think you've got to kind of have some commitment to whoever's sponsoring you as well. We have been offered money by things like toilet roll manufacturers. And I kind of really, I can't, I, I mean, I do have a connection, obviously, but you know, not that much of a connection. And so we've gone and done, we've done gardens. I mean, after that Bowel Disease UK one, we worked with Blind Veterans UK, and we'd done a pro bono project for a 4-acre woodland garden. I mean, it was a woodland that was there and you couldn't get into it. We did a load of work with them, and we absolutely adored working with them. It was great fun. And they turned around and said, would you do a show garden? Because they kind of knew there were people out there they could help, but they weren't getting to them. And they kind of saw gardens as a way of doing that. So I put something together, went to see the board of trustees. The CEO, after I presented, said, oh, so you decided to do a large garden, did you, Andrew? And and we went ahead and did it. And it's the largest garden they've ever had at Hampton Court Palace, Splash Show. But it was great. It was a big circular garden. Circular gardens are always really great, by the way, because you hit them as a visitor and then you walk around them. So as an exhibitor, you've got multiple opportunities to actually speak to people. Whereas if you do a like rectangular garden, you hit them and people walk along the side and walk off.
Yeah.
So it's like, but we did it. And I never forget sitting there talking to a veteran on the garden. And I heard somebody went behind me swear with an Australian accent. And went, bloody went and did a bigger, you went, bloody went and did a bigger one, didn't you? And I turned around, it was Michael Bates, and he'd come all the way from Australia to see this garden. How cool is that,
yeah.
You know, to get that support and things. So, yeah, and that garden got relocated, parts of it have been relocated again because they've sold that site. But great fun, because we had 65 people work on it, amazing craftspeople, like blacksmiths and willow lip weavers, people like Tom Hare, and it was really enjoyable. And we got the best construction award. We got a gold medal. And I turned around to Dan and said, we're not going to do any more because we kind of finish on a high. That's the kind of way to do it. Some designers don't know when to stop.
Yeah. So did you talk to them about, was it as successful that they hoped it to be as well? Like, were they able to reach more people?
They at the time, the day after the kind of press day, and we'd had their patron is who is now the Duchess of Edinburgh, and she came down. There was a very funny front page photo on the front page of the Times, and it was the chief executive, the Duchess of Edinburgh, and myself, who was apparently a veteran. they didn't bother to find out who I was, but that's fine. And she came down, it was great. They got on the front page of the Washington Post, stuff like that. They had something like over a year, they I remember them saying they had some like 20 articles they get into the press, and they had something like 650 from one garden. They had people coming on talking to them about leaving their property and their will to them, kind of those sort of things, you know. And to be honest, they kind of weren't really working it as much as they could have.
Yeah.
But we had veterans down to show people around and talk about it. The average age of blind veterans members is 87, and they are amazingly optimistic. It was set, the charity was set up to help all the men coming back from the trenches in the First World War with mustard gas poisoning. And they came back, and it was to give them, to retrain them so they could lead independent lives. And we had in the garden, we had this willow vine that went in and out of the ground, massive structure. You can see it on our website. And it was brilliant. And we had green oak buildings and things. And we had help from people like the carver at St. George's Chapel in Windsor, carved into this green oak building. But so we had this willow and the vine and things. And during what I later found out, I have to admit I didn't know this when we designed it, but there is something called the great grapevine at Hampton Court Palace. It's 450 year old vine, and during the First World War, because all the gardeners went to fight, when the blind veterans came back, they went and maintained the great grapevine at Hampton Court Palace. And they also taught people how to weave baskets. And it was the patriotic thing to have on your dinner table, a woven basket with grapes from the grapevine at Hampton Court. And people paid like £30 for this and things. And it turned out, and it was just by sheer chance. And we'd done all that. Of course, I told the press that we'd thought this through. And it was intended. But yeah, also there are awesome people to work with. Really, really great. And really enjoyed it. There was like, do you have over here the Hairy Bikers?
Yeah, I've heard.
And they came down every day. They were doing a TV show at lunchtime, came down to talk to the veterans. And Cy, his father, was a white cap who kind of was in submarines in the North Sea and across, you know, during the war. And they came down and talked. And of course, Dave has just died. But amazing guys. I mean, just, you know, not doing it with any cameras or there. They just came down and talked to these veterans every day. Really cool.
Yeah, there's a bit of similarities about Peter Donegan's garden that he's doing this year with the Department of Veterans Affairs. I got that name wrong, but basically, yeah, supporting people who are coming back and struggling to get back used to normal life. So he's doing a garden to basically support them. So what do you think about doing garden when you're doing a show garden? Because some people do, like my garden I did last year, it's basically like a real garden. And then there's other people who do it for a bigger reason as well.
The important thing is you're telling a story, you know. I mean, it's kind of the one place where you are a kind of, you actually have to explain yourself because somebody's going to judge you against it. And you need to tell good stories, but you need a good narrative with anything you do. And I teach that with, you know, planting design in particular. And as long as you're doing that and you're kind of telling people, well, this is a garden that you could take home yourself, you know, and do things. And a lot of gardens are about kind of take home ideas as well. You know, that garden I was telling you about in New Zealand, loads of people came back and said, oh, I'm going to go and put some logs around the tree and we're going to sit and look at the tree. Yeah. It's kind of, you know, great. You know, that's all you can hope for. And, you know, I've also done conceptual gardens, which are kind of more about telling a story and, you know, that they are what they are. So it doesn't bother me one way or another. I mean, going back, I just kind of pick up on what you're just saying about veterans. I'm a patron of veterans growth in the UK. I have an interest in kind of social and therapeutic horticulture. And we've got that kind of long collaboration with veterans charities. And so veterans growth are near Hastings in Sussex. Do you know Sarah Wilson, who runs a podcast called Roots and All?
I've heard the podcast, yeah.
So Roots and All. So Sarah's the head of Veterans Growth, and they use horticulture to help veterans with a lot of issues, you know, particularly PTSD, but often if they've got PTSD, they've got other issues as well. And it's quite a remarkable work that they're doing. But it's also kind of also quite remarkable to see how therapeutic horticulture can help people who really need it. And you know, veterans as a group often have that sort of support, and long may it last.
Yeah. There's a lot of it happening in hospitals as well, like therapeutic horticulture in there, helping people they're making insane improvements in their health when they're getting involved with nature and horticulture. So, yeah, the more people in it, the better.
The Scottish Government is talking about putting 5% of the National Health Service budget into outdoor space.
Yeah, right.
Which says something, isn't it? There's obviously the proof that it works now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And going back to when you're in Sydney and you were talking about how some of the Australian guys knew that you were from Europe because you're planting positioning. Yeah. So what particularly was it that you were doing differently?
I think what it was, the garden was, the planting was very naturalistic. So it was kind of built using a matrix system. It's kind of like, more like someone like Thomas Rayner would do. So if you've read Thomas Rayner and Claudia West's book, Planting in a Post-Wild World, you kind of know what they do. And a lot of their work is based on the work of kind of some of the people who design and manage parks in Germany and the Netherlands, and they've kind of taken it forward and made it much more accessible to designers to understand. So the planting was kind of along that, very naturalistic, very relaxed, and not as kind of naturalistic as someone, say, like Nigel Dunnett. Nigel teaches for me, and, you know, kind of amazing what he does, but it's kind of more, that planting is much more based on lists and instructions, so that even if you have the same list and the same instructions, if you get somebody else doing it, they'll create a different planting scheme. So it was kind of very, very naturalistic there from that point, and anchored by just a few key plants like Dorianthus, which obviously by now you realize is a favorite of mine, but also things like Westringia as a constant sort of repetition that's kind of sequenced through that planting. The other gardens that were there, which were all by Australians, were much more ornamental planting. So kind of much more traditional planting, the kind of planting you'll see in 90% of gardens, and in some ways more worked out. I remember standing there talking to Miles Baldwin and looking at his garden, and he kind of had five of those and seven of those and nine of those, and they kind of formed that ornamental look, which, you know, we all love. And works. But I kind of went in and, you know, did something different. I had made one condition of coming over to do it, which was when I was looking for plants and things, that I had somebody with me who would say, Andrew, that's not a native. Because, you know, I had limited knowledge and limited palette of Australian plants. And I had this young woman from the nursery help me, and she was just absolutely brilliant. But I also kind of went into that. I had this big story, talking about narratives, and a big story. It was called, the headline was September Sky, and it was kind of our idea, or my idea, of what an Australian landscape is, kind of these big skies and, you know, and something much more naturalistic, I guess. Still controlled, because I chose the plants, but it is what it is. But we also kind of told small surface sort of stories. The kind of underlying theme was, when you scratch the surface of Australia, you find treasure. And so where the rocks have been scratched by the machinery in the quarry, we actually put a bit of gold leaf on the rocks. I have to say there, somebody very foolishly went and put paints crosses on the rocks to say they were the ones we wanted. And then somebody spent 3 days trying to get rid of these crosses. If you're doing a show garden, never do that. So we kind of put this gold leaf on, and then we didn't tell anyone. And I love doing that. I love not telling people. And so they kind of have to discover it themselves, and was kind of suddenly going, oh my God, look, there's gold in that rock. You know, and then they came and told you and things. And we also had stuff like, I made sure we had the national flower of Australia, golden wattle, within there, which I don't know was introduced by the second Prime Minister of Australia, Andrew Fisher. Can you really? Yeah, so kind of had to be. So, you know, those small stories are great to kind of tell, which is kind of the big story as well. And if you go and visit people's gardens, people who are open gardens, and they kind of want to talk to you and tell you about their gardens, and you know, they tell you those little stories, which kind of what makes gardening interesting.
Yeah, that's something I'm only just picking up. Like, I've been in the industry nearly 20 years, but I'm only just, like, in the last 12 months, I think, really getting to understand that there's so much more deeper meaning behind a lot of gardens. So, and it's just so fascinating when you get to talk to someone and find out that type of thing as well.
Yeah. You kind of, whatever garden you do, you need to have a bit of a story. Sometimes that comes from the client. More often, the client is coming to you because they can't see the opportunities. So you kind of create that with them by talking to them. That's certainly what I teach our students.
So with the London College Gardeners on, you started that, is that right?
Yeah, back in 2007. Andrew Wilson and I, we kind of had a conversation. We were both in conversation with other colleges to buy them out. We thought, well, that's stupid. Let's spend our money doing our own. And we brought Mark Gregory into that as well. Mark Gregory is kind of like the Martin Semkin of the UK. I think they're quite rivals. And strange enough, I think last time I was over him, Mark's son was working for Martin. So, so we set that up. We based in Kew Gardens, very happy there. We have three main courses, the main one being a garden design program, which is a year, and then we have a planting design diploma and a construction program. And when we set up here, it was kind of Brent was leading that and saying, you kind of need to be over here, because he said he'd wished he'd trained with us. We kind of thought, we'll do what we'd always wanted to do, which is to do a two-year course. So the two-year course we have here basically embraces all those. You get a lot more construction on it. You get the planting design diploma as part of it. And of course, with developments with Victoria around requiring people to kind of, you know, do some construction design detail training and things like that, we're kind of quite well placed with that. And it's a different course, but it's kind of it's taught by Australian specialists, but it's kind of the same principles. Everyone who teaches for us is out there working. You don't get people who are just teaching. You get people who are actually working, and they know what sort of modern requirements are. They understand the challenges we have these days, particularly from in terms of things like sustainability and climate change. And so you get taught by those people and you kind of hear real stories. And that's really important to us.
Yeah, and they're not just anybody's there, that anyone working in the industry. Like this, I've seen some of the names of the guest lecturers you have in the UK and certainly the ones that they have in Melbourne. There's some huge names that they're sharing their knowledge.
We're very fortunate. We kind of got to a point where people kind of want to come and teach for us and come and speak to people. And quite often, if Nina Baxter came on board last year as director, she's taken over from me running the planting design diploma to kind of give me a bit more free time. And, you know, if Nina and I kind of are interested in somebody, we'll get them to come and talk. Because we, you know, we're as much interested as well. So, you know, there's some really interesting people out there doing really interesting, you know, fascinating stuff. And kind of, you know, if we can promote that so people, you know, listen and discover something new, because it is, we kind of need to be innovating all the time these days. So be it, you know, that's a good thing to do. So, yeah.
And what was it like at the start when you were, when you've started your own course, and then at the end of that, people get qualified in your course, trying to make that mean something?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, a lot of it comes from, it's a bit like Kew Gardens, you know, there's a diploma there and it means something. And we're the same in the UK. We usually are fully booked 9 months before the course starts. We have a wait list. People, you know, they plan, and it means that people are very serious about studying with us, and they go on to great things. Last year at last year at Chelsea Flower Show, 25% of the gardens were our graduates. I think it's similar this year. People like Tom Massey, who's making a name for himself, things, you know. So it kind of, the proof is in the pudding, that what do people do when they graduate? 75% of our students set up on their own, 25% go to work for other practices. And there are a lot of jobs in that way, but our graduates are sought after because they are made industry ready. Yeah, they leave with knowledge. They leave with things like an understanding of construction design that is seldom taught on design courses. And it comes from a point of view that kind of we're all still working, so we kind of want, you know, who do we want to employ as well? So that informs our syllabus. It informs us to keep changing, keep developing the course. It's not modular led. It's actually quite layered. So something you learn in the first 2 weeks, you're still using in week 26, week 36, whatever, you know, so it keeps building. And certainly us, I mean, we opened the doors here 3 days before lockdown. I was on one of the last planes to leave Australia. It was kind of, you know, and you know, the first 2 years were hard because, I mean, fortunately, we had a lot of experience of doing online training. But it also kind of, a bit like I was saying about Showgrounds, it kind of forced us to be a bit creative about how we do this. And we've developed a course now, which is blended learning for everybody. But some people come into class and some people do the whole course online. Some people do a bit of each. They come in for certain things like nursery visits or something like that. So we've got quite a few of the online students coming into town at the moment, so because they're helping out graduates and admittedly some existing students at Mifkis doing gardens. And so it's kind of nice. It's quite flexible. It's quite fluid. People can come in, or they can be at home, and it works, really well.
Yeah, I had Brent on. Oh, it would have been like episode 6 or 7, and we're 180 something into it now, so it was a while ago. But after hearing him talk about what the college does, that's what I recommend people to do now if they're wanting to learn landscape design, because it's such a well-rounded course. Because there's a lot of like people, landscape architects don't have, they might have one unit on plants over 4 years, so their plant knowledge is extremely low, and just the fact that they're learning something about construction as well, because that's I've had landscape designers on who went and did construction, so they had a better understanding of how it all worked, how it all goes together. So the fact that it's actually a course that teaches, you know, as well rounded as you can be doing a course in 2 years, it's a no brainer.
Well, thank you for doing that.
I don't know if anyone listens, but it's,
you know, you're helping pay my airfare over.
But yeah, that's the thing, though. Like the fact that you're two people in the industry who have made the course, rather than sort of a government making a course or, you know, paying people for their recommendations on what should be involved, I think it's a much better option.
We've got kind of a nice working relationship with London. Obviously, I'm at both. So we're kind of always looking at what we're doing. I'm teaching a lot more around sustainability now. I've been given a new title, and I'm kind of interested in kind of requirements for biodiversity and sustainable measurements and things like that. And the Australians are great at sustainability compared to the Brits. And people always kind of hear, they go, oh, yeah, right. And it's like, no, you seriously are. You kind of got a better understanding of it. Partly because I think you have more extreme climates as well. So I can learn a lot from there, and I take it back to London. And there's other stuff, you know, if I get a great person like Nigel Dunnett in, we can kind of get the Australian students in listening in as well. So, yeah, it's good. And, you know, and also to have an alumni that can, you know, if you're an Australian and turn up for a couple of years in London, as some have, we can help you out there. You can come to staff. We can put you in contact with people. And then while I'm over here, I'm seeing three UK graduates who are now living in Melbourne and Sydney.
Yeah, cool.
It's kind of nice, you know, that sort of the conversations you can have, really.
These people. I love that about the industry, how well like everyone gets along. And that's my favorite thing about garden shows as well. How good the camaraderie is. And that's a prime example of that is where Michael Bates came over to the UK to see you for your garden.
And, you know, next week, hopefully, Charlie Auburn and Graham Ross are going to have a coffee and catch up. I'm going to do a bit of promotion, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about it anyway.
All right, yeah, Global Footprint Scholarships is brilliant organisation here that provides bursaries to young people, I think between 18 and 25. You need to check that out, for lots of different trades. So it's even like tiling and plumbing and whatever, but the horticulture one's quite big. It's been quite successful. Graham's involved in it, helps choose those people who get the bursaries, and then he introduces them to me, and we get them in placements with things like helping at Chelsea Flower Show, going to work at Kew Gardens, going to heritage sites. Graham usually has got a connection with Giverny, you know, Monet's Garden in France, and there'll be somebody go there. And, you know, somebody's paying you to do this, you know, it's kind of a lot, go 6 months. Ash Walker, who is a bursary scholar from 2 years ago, he's been back to Europe. He's coming back shortly. And I managed to get a place with Kate Gould, who's an amazing designer, amazing plants woman. And he went and helped her at Chelsea. They're now sponsoring him to go and work in the UK for 2 years because of kind of the attitude he showed and everything, and they kind of love him, you know. So definitely, if you're thinking, if there's anyone listening in on this and they're thinking that kind of, you know, they want to get into a horticulture, there's an opportunity there. Have a look at globalfootprints.org.au, because I think applications are open very soon or around now for next year. Yeah, have a go at it, definitely.
Yeah, I've had Bryce Hillig on an episode, and he was there last year. Or just got back.
I love it because I go to places and I hear Andrew, and it's somebody from that season. You know, I mean, at the flower show next week, Annika Zetterman is doing a garden. She used to work for me.
All right.
Annika and I go back a long time, and she actually came to me 1 year and said, "So Andrew," she said, "the winters are cold and dark, and I'm not sure kind of what I should be doing through the winters in Sweden." And I said, "Write a book." And she wrote me Nordic Gardens, and the rest is history. And, you know, Kayser and Kayser, actually, I met in Sydney. And she's based there. She's Swedish. She's old friend of Annika, introduced me. Kays and I ended up doing a miniature garden show in London together. Like a model garden show. So kind of all these networks are brilliant. You know, you just need to get out there and talk to people.
Yeah. I talk to Peter Donegan every now and then as well for that. And all we did was meet at Melbourne.
Yeah.
We just started a good relationship from that.
But you go to, you know, have a conversation with Peter, you kind of need to give it a few hours, don't you?
Yeah. That's why he's a good podcast guest. You ask him a question, he'll just ramble on and you've got no idea what the question was when you get back.
I would never do that.
When you went to, and were judging at Chelsea, had you done any judging before that?
I mean, the way the RHS do judging, you get trained. So you're kind of a nominated judge, but you don't get a vote or anything. And you kind of observe first. You're not allowed to say anything. Then you're allowed to say something. And then eventually, you know, they're reported, you know, there's a report written about you and then you're invited.
You know, so people judging the judges.
Well, yeah, but if you think about it, you know, what happens if you've got a sponsor who doesn't like the fact they got a silver medal and takes you to court and says, you know, well, they're not skilled. Yeah. So you kind of have to be able to prove that they're skilled people. They know what they're talking about.
Mm. So it wasn't intimidating at all then doing that the first time?
No, that's all right. They're all quite nice people.
Yep.
you know, you've got nice people here like Andrew Laidlaw looking after you, so.
Yeah,
they do the best. You know, most judges try to get the best possible medal for people. You know, they're trying to get the best possible award, and it's kind of a positive thing. But you should never go as an exhibitor and think, I've got to get a gold medal, because you know you're never on the day. You're what you've done might not kind of work with for the judges. I mean, I've got everything going. I've got I can't remember. I have got a bronze. Oh, I've got a bronze. Yeah, I did a little extra garden somewhere at the show. I've got a silver gilt, a gold, and I've got a no award because this little balcony garden we did, somebody thought that we'd bought all the vegetables on it from Tesco's, from the supermarket. And actually, they come from Clive West's allotment. And he was most distraught that anyone would think that he was kind of mass-produced vegetables. But, you know, it doesn't matter. Nobody cares. No, we move on.
Yeah. Like it's nice in the moment to win, you know, the gold or the good result. But at the end of the day, people remember the gardens, not what the medal was that it won.
Years ago, I used to advertise that we'd won RHS medals. And somebody rang me one day and said, I don't suppose I can afford you because you've got an RHS medal.
Mm.
And I took it off all our advertising and our response rate doubled. So it's not all that. And most of my overseas clients, particularly in Europe, have said to me at some point, you know, we kind of dismiss the RHS medal because everybody's got one in the UK.
Award-winning designer.
Yeah. Kind of, you know, people are interested in what you're doing now and what you're doing in real gardens. So, you know, go to shows and have some fun and, you know, enjoy it and things, but it ain't the be-all and end-all.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was who spoke to him, but when I heard Philip Johnson speaking about after he got best in show at Chelsea, he came back and his phone stopped ringing because everyone thought he was too expensive.
Yeah. And it was a superb garden. It was just an amazing garden. There was a controversy there that I ended up going and apologising to Philip for the way that some British designers had treated him. And he said to me, very graciously, he said, thanks, Andrew, but, you know, I just think it's probably a bit disrespectful because although I'm from another country, we're all in the same industry. And he was absolutely right, you know, but he took it really well.
So, well, they were whinging about the garden.
Yeah, it's a long story to tell over a pint.
Have you been out to his recreation on this trip?
No, I haven't, no. I've been to a few places, not least a festival in Dalesford, but that's another thing. And, yeah, so I've got a few trips lined up and things, so, yeah.
Yep. So your show garden days are done?
Never say never. You know, it might be the last thing I do. It depends how the planting at the entrance to Mythicus goes next. They offered me money to do a garden. I was like, no, I'm too busy and I've done that. You need to finish on a high, I think.
Yeah.
I've got lots on it. And I think also you need to let young people, new people to the industry do it. You know, let them have a go. Stop standing in, you know, there are too many people who kind of go away and come back 10 years later because they're not getting the recognition and things, and they kind of do it again. And it's just like, no, let young, newer people get on, because it's far more interesting, far more interesting.
Yeah. And you can learn new things as well. That can keep you fresh and innovative by, you know, getting ideas from other people.
I mean, I'm always looking for new opportunities to do stuff. You know, Peter did a garden in France for, you know, representing sort of the Irish involvement in the First World War. We did one for Wales as well. And it was kind of an amazing experience. And we're kind of always looking for that sort of thing. Just, I was showing students today a magic lantern slide of Carlton Gardens and the exhibition hall. And they said, are you sure that's right? Because there's a massive piece of water in front. And I went, yeah, isn't that amazing? There's an opportunity. It's not there anymore, but there's an opportunity. So you kind of, it's like this, what I was saying about the Australian garden, you know, there's treasure everywhere and it ain't just show gardens.
Mm. Yeah, I get jealous about people who can't put those ideas, because I love it. They're deep, you can think.
Mm. There you go.
So what's coming up next for yourself? Are you still designing gardens?
I'm still designing gardens. I'm doing quite a lot of planting design for various people, but as well as being over there, there's a book coming. I've resisted for many years, but I got a very good offer from a very good publisher. So that should be out this time next year. So I'll come back on and talk to you about it to flog it. And so that's in process at the moment. Yeah, just trying to think. Not really thought about it. More of the same, I think, as well. But it's like you say, it's a great industry to be in. It's good.
And you're still doing a lot of traveling for gardens?
Not so much. I mean, we used to do a lot of work overseas, but we are, the design company is a much smaller company now, in terms of what we do, and we do a lot more closer to home. And actually, you can design overseas gardens easily from the comfort of your own office. Mm. You know, it's what Gertrude Jekyll did. So she never went and saw one of these gardens. So, you know,
I don't think she didn't have Zoom either, I don't think.
Well, exactly. Well, FaceTime and landscaper taking you around a garden in the Caribbean. Sometimes those are quite good tax deductible holidays. So,
yeah. Depends on the weather. Yep.
Yeah.
Last question for you, Andrew. Who do you think would be a good guest to have on the podcast?
Oh, right. Actually, Sarah Wilson would be brilliant, because her knowledge is really good. And she's a fellow podcaster as well. I mean, anyone who has a who has a half hour with somebody who does human waste composting is, you know, bound to be interesting. And I'd say actually have Sarah on, and you can return the compliment. She can interview you.
All right. I'll see what. Yep, that sounds like a great idea. So, but I can't thank you enough for coming on. Absolutely loved having this chat, and I've been looking forward to it since you agreed. So thank you so much for coming on, and looking forward to catching up with you.
Excellent. Thanks a lot, Noel.